This is Building Bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Now, Legacy of Violence, A History of British Empire, an extraordinary forum sponsored by Revolution Books and hosted by Raymond Loda, writer for rev.com.us, featuring Carolyn Elkins, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Imperial Reckoning, The Unsold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya, who discusses her new book, Legacy of Violence Could Not Be More Relevant in the Wake of the Wall-to-Wall Mourning of Queen Elizabeth, and the sentimentalizing obfuscation of brutality underlining the empire the sun never sets on. Elkins rips off the veil to reveal how slavery, genocide, pillage, and plunder is the foundation of the global British Empire.
I want to thank all of you for coming out to this very special program. My name is Raymond Loda. I am a spokesperson for Revolution Books. I'm a political economist and writer for revcom.us. You're going to be meeting and hearing and engaging with Caroline Elkins and her book, Legacy of Violence, A History of the British Empire. Caroline is a professor of history at Harvard University, the founding director of the Center for African Studies. An earlier work of hers, Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya, for which she won a Pulitzer Prize in 2006. We're very excited and very honored to have her here to present this new book. You know, this is a work of extraordinary scholarship, and it's a work of great rigor that's matched by incredible passion. So we're very honored to have Caroline with us. Well, I'm going to bring Caroline Elkins to the stage. She'll take it from here.
What an honor it is to be here at a bookstore that I've so long admired with all of you and with all the team for Revolution Books. So I'd like to make some broad remarks about the book itself and then have an opportunity to read a few passages to you to give you a sense of some of the texture of what I'm up to. It's also a very timely. Queen's funeral was last week. As an historian, it was one that was pregnant with meaning about the nation's imperial past as well as the monarchy's and hers very overdetermined role in it. Been to London, you'll see the grand memorials and statues celebrating the empire has proliferated ever since the Victorian, and London has become, over these last 150 years, a commemorative imperial and sort of royal parade ground. And as we saw, it was center stage for the Queen's funeral. And I watched that funeral very carefully with my spouse. We're up early, and I was looking for all the symbols of empire that were all over this funeral. And even her casket felt the weight of empire bearing down upon it, with the crown and the scepter resting on top of it. And of course, the jewels extracted from across the empire, including South Africa's famous and massive Cullinan diamonds, one over 3,000 carats, some of which landed in the scepter, and then the other several hundred carats which landed into the crown. And so the queen was being laid to rest. The imperial history wars with the public, politicians, scholars, the media, hotly contested the meanings, the lived experiences, legacies of the British Empire. And these have been long simmering and have been exploding at different points, particularly as the time of following George Floyd's murder and the backdraft of the Black Lives Movement that very much became global. Since then, it has been very much on the rise, and we have been seeing these fault lines that have been existing beginning to rupture quite fully, right, around the question of empire, around the question of British imperial benevolence. And so it's these imperial history wars and their profound salience today, and raises this question of, how do we in the present understand the past and the ways in which it shapes the world in which we're living? And it's these questions, I think, that very much animate Legacy of Violence and questions that it's seeking to answer, suggesting in some ways that it's time to advance our conversation beyond whether or not empire was a good or bad thing. It's accepting as fact that this violence has occurred, beyond whether is it a force of evil or progress, to the question about how and why coercion was a cornerstone of Britain's reformist agenda in the empire. its civilizing mission, its white man's burden, as it's been called. And it's a book that's been well over a decade in the making. The idea came for it from my last book, Imperial Reckoning, which was mentioned in some of the introductory remarks, which very much did seek to establish that Britain deployed systematic violence in Kenya in the 1950s in its detention camps as a way of suppressing the Mau Mau emergency and then covered up its own incriminating evidence. That book, when it came out in 2005, had a very different kind of reception. There had certainly been others working on violence. It was a book that had critical acclaim with much more emphasis on the critical than the acclaim. The difference between then and now, 17 years later, in terms of the reception of books, whereas, you know, with this, there's a robust debate going on around questions of empire, except for sort of the far right, we're past the questions of did this happen or not. I feel particularly proud of the fact of that first book seeking to establish as fact this had happened. And then the book, of course, then becomes the evidentiary basis for the first time the British government was sued by a former colonized population in London's High Court. In 2009, former victims of the detention camps, five of them filed suit for systematic violence and torture in these detention camps in London's High Court. And I was expert witness for the case. The case was then settled in 2013. In the course of that, there was new files were discovered. The British government disclosed that it was keeping approximately 300 boxes of undisclosed files in Hanslope Park, which was better known as Spook Central, where they keep all their MI5 and MI6 documents. Those files become important in terms of the writing of this book. They also become important to the case. The case was settled 4 years later after it was filed in 2009, resulting in an unprecedented settlement where the British government admitted to torture for the first time in the British Empire, settled for £2 million sterling, and offered an official apology, which was actually an official sincere regret as opposed to apology, because sincere regret doesn't trigger more liability. But nevertheless, the sentiment was very much the same. Questions remained when I had finished the Imperial Reckoning, and I felt, and it had become clear to me that I had dropped into one moment in time with Kenya, and it was part of a much larger story, a story where imperial agents circulated throughout the 19th and 20th century empire, moving from one location to the next, where coercion and reform rested very much uncomfortably with each other and were bound together by this notion of British liberal imperialism. And this liberal imperialism was thought to be unique, and it still is very much so in some corners, that its civilizing mission would bring developmentalism with a paternalistic heavy hand to 700 million colonial subjects across a quarter of the world's landmass, which is the largest empire in human history. But liberal imperialism with this coercion and reforms was very much, if you think about it, right, it's an oxymoron, a dualism that can only be explained if we keep both of these in the same frame of historical analysis. If we ask how and why coercion and reform were two sides of empire's developmentalist coin. What is this dualism of coercion and reform? And well, after Britain waged about 250 wars in the 19th century to extend sovereignty over these vast swaths, approximately a quarter of the world's landmass, these vast swaths of territory that ostensibly never had sovereignty, according to the British, and to pacify colonial subjects, or as Kipling called it, the Savage Wars of Peace, contested though coherent ideology of liberal imperialism emerged. And this integrated sort of sovereign imperial claims with a huge undertaking. On the one hand, they have claims to this territory, which they're going to exploit for economic reasons, whilst at the same time a huge undertaking to reform colonial subjects, often called quote-unquote children. The idea being that through tutelage and developmentalist policies, Britain would usher hundreds of millions of people into the modern world, determining when these subject populations, mostly brown and black, were civilized and prepared to stand on their own two feet, and that this process, the civilizing mission, would take generations, if not more. But if Britain's civilizing mission was reformist in its claims, it was brutal nonetheless. Nationalists and freedom fighters were often cast as criminals or terrorists in their actions, including vandalism, labor strikes, riots, full-blown rebellions, were cast as political threats. Coercion would not just subdue these so-called recalcitrant children, as they were often called at the time. Colonial officials and security forces instead wanted their infantilized subjects to see and feel their own suffering. They called it the quote-unquote moral effect of violence. At the same time, British officials obsessed over the rule of law, insisting that this was the basis of good government in the empire. But rule of law in the empire was a bit of a fever dream. Rule of law codified difference, curtailed freedoms, expropriated land and property and ensured a steady stream of labor for the empire's mines and plantations, the profits of which helped to fuel Britain's economy. By the 20th century, the empire becomes replete with legal exceptionalism. Basic laws could no longer keep control. And this legal exceptionalism takes the form of martial law and eventually states of emergency, or sort of statutory martial law, needed to maintain colonial control. While lawful, these states of exception granted extraordinary powers of repression. When security forces needed more discretion, or when their actions constituted unsanctioned violence, British officials rendered their behavior legal by amending old regulations and creating new ones. This process of making legal otherwise or previously illegal behavior and protecting British security forces from prosecution is something that I term legalized lawlessness. This recurring phenomenon turned the exceptions into the norm, and British security forces deployed ever-intensifying forms of systematic violence, making the empire look more and more like a recurring conquest state as opposed to one that was moving eventually towards independence through this civilizing mission. And a well-oiled repressive machinery emerged, directed from London and transferred from one imperial location to the next by colonial officials and security forces. And ideas move through people. And in this case, in the British Empire, security forces, colonial officials, and the like were moving from one colony to the next, right? So if you imagine it almost like the spinning of the silks of a spider web, where they're all sort of connecting around. And it's not until you paint this out and you step back and you get a sense of the enormity of this and the ways in which these different wars and these different individuals are connecting things across the empire. Prior to the Second World War, these processes of systematized repression played out across, as I said, the empire. And we start with South Africa, India, Ireland, Palestine, to name a few places. But it's in the post-war period where that we see liberal imperialism, I think, facing its greatest test. And it was a time when, in theory, promises of wartime freedom, as encapsulated in the Atlantic Charter, would be kept. There are lots of back and forth as to what, in fact, Britain actually promised with the Atlantic Charter. Churchill said that, in fact, yes, they had promised to return sovereignty, but it was to places in Eastern Europe that had been taken over by Nazi Germany, that places in the empire weren't going to get their sovereignty back because they never had it in the first places. In the post-war period, is Britain embarking on a broad policy of what's called imperial resurgence. This policy of imperial resurgence first takes place under the Labour government of Attlee. It transcends political party. Then again, under the conservatives of Churchill and Eden and Macmillan that we know. The empire was thought would rescue Britain from its financial perils, financial Armageddon, and also secure its place, its status in the big three with the Soviet Union and the United States. We end up seeing happening during the war, FDR was quite outspoken against imperialism at the time. Right before his death and before Truman comes in, he backpedals from this. And ultimately, with the rise of the Soviet Union, it's understood that Britain's empire was exceedingly important in terms of bolstering democratic governments against the rising red tide. And in fact, they're willing to sacrifice the needs of the United States and sort of geopolitics, sacrifice the needs of independence movements with this. And so what we end up seeing is we see the Americans and the Brits, the Anglo-American alliance, very uncomfortable bedfellows in some of this, but nonetheless, Britain, in many instances, doing some of the bidding for the United States, and certainly the United States turning a blind eye to what Britain is doing in many of these end of empire wars. And eventually, of course, ends up barring from some of it later on in Vietnam and elsewhere with things like Strategic Hamlet and the like. But in many ways, empire was on a bit of an overdetermined collision course, with many of these policies and practices having been so honed prior to the Second World War. And for the first three decades after World War II, the first 30 years of Queen Elizabeth II's reign were consistently year over year punctuated by recurring end of empire wars, beginning in Malaya, then Kenya. Oh, actually, prior to her taking the throne, we had partition of India, not necessarily an end of empire war, but certainly Palestine. She comes in the throne in 1952, and Malaya is underway, soon followed by Kenya, Cyprus, British Guiana, Nyasaland, Aden, Northern Ireland, to name but a few. British security forces, in an effort to regain imperial control, move through the empire, unleashing wide-scale detention without trial and illegal deportations. In Malaya and Kenya, they forcibly relocated hundreds of thousands of subjects into barbed wire villages, in fact, the largest forced movement of population since the trade in enslaved peoples. Colonial subjects were forced to labor. starvation were forms of colonial control. In each conflict, there were kill squads deployed and populations terrorized. These were extraordinary. There's massive wars that lasted for a very long period of time. By massive, I mean in terms of impact, of scope of the impact of these wars. Throughout, liberal imperialism endured, giving rise to new lexicons for reform. So we talked about the moral effect of violence before. Post-World War period, that's no longer, lack of better terms, a fashionable phrase. So now colonial subjects were being rehabilitated. Updated post-war humanitarian laws and new human rights conventions, particularly in this instance, the European Convention on Human Rights, were legally and politically very problematic, particularly on Britain's widespread use of torture. They partly prompted the government's doublespeak when the British government repeatedly denied repressive measures and claiming any instance of brutality was isolated. It was the fault of one individual colonial officials, what were known at the time as bad apples. Meanwhile, the British government was, of course, covering this up massively at the time, and at the era of at the point of decolonization, ordering widespread destruction of incriminating evidence and the packing up and removal of others. And so when I refer to those documents that were found during that Kenya trial, those were some of the documents that escaped the incinerators at the end of Empire and that had been packed up and sent back to London where they were kept under lock and key. Those were the documents we used, some of those within the Mau case, and some of these end up landing up and being used in this book. Tell the fullness of this story, I set out to research and write a history of the British Empire through the lens of state-directed violence. I see that as a kind of violence that really throws into relief a lot of the things that I'm interested in. There are all kinds of other violences in the empire, epistemological, we're thinking about violence within sort of local community. Right now, so I'm interested when we have martial law, when we have a declared state of emergency, when the troops come in, when the police forces are deployed. How was it, despite the fact of all these cover-ups, there's lots of information coming back to Britain that things are not right in the empire, that these that things are happening. We have many people on the far left, Barbara Castle and others. We have many from within the empire, importantly, many from the Caribbean, from Africa, from South Asia, that are raising the flag, that are calling these incidents out. And the question becomes, how is it that the public at home is able to continually rework this notion of liberal imperialism such that they continue to see the empire or Britain as doing something exceptional in terms of its civilizing mission relative to everybody else, particularly the wretched French, because you know the French are always the bête noire. What we come to find out is that this post-World War II period, so many of the policies and practices and systems are being put into place actually prior to the Second World War. And it's quite stunning, actually, how much this is unfolding across the empire. It actually comes back to Europe and is deployed in Europe and also in various venues during World War II against the fascist regimes, and then is exported back out into the empire. And the book itself is bookended by two trials, the famous Warren Hastings impeachment trial. And for those of you, I got some head nods in the back, you know your history from the 19th century, from the 18th century, and then the Mau Mau trial. So the final result is a book that reveals the bureaucratic and legal machinery of oppression, and it's and really, this long durée over the 19th and 20th centuries, many would say carrying out into the present day. And it's also a book that very much dissects this question of liberal imperialism. But there's still lots of folks out there, who still think about British exceptionalism. And so what I'd like to do is just give you a little bit of a flavor of some of what's going on in the book. You know, we'll move around a little bit within the empire, right? To give you a sense, so Sir Henry Gurney was the chief secretary in Palestine, I mentioned before, in Palestine, and that was a big war when it happens right after World War II. The Zionists eventually are successful. Britain loses that war in Palestine. He is brought into Gurney is to Malaya. When he arrives in Malaya in 1949, he says, in Palestine, the emergency regulations were continually being added to and tightened up, so that at the end it might almost have been said that the whole book of regulations could have been expressed in a single provision, empowering the High Commissioner to take any action he wished to take. I like their honesty. He goes on to launch what is a massive deportation campaign. The emergency that's being waged in Malaya is largely targeted at Chinese communists. They are looking to deport as many Chinese squatters, as they were known, back to China. Many had been living in Malaya for generations. They were very much what was in legal speak, they belonged to the territory. Gurney launched a deportation campaign, the intended scale of which was unprecedented in the empire. In January 1949, he set repatriation quotas of 2,000 per month for all inhabitants deemed alien to the Federation along with their dependents. Malcolm MacDonald, disparaged in the communist circles as the, quote, white monkey leader, called the new regulations drastic but imperative, in his words, because it would help solve the quote-unquote racial problem. The Colonial Secretary was aware of the campaign against so-called alien Chinese squatters, as they called them, noting, and he says, there is no appeal from any order made under the new regulations, and no such order can be called in question by any court. He said that, of course, this is a grave injustice, but I accept it as a fait accompli. We then have a parliamentary delegation that comes to visit and comes to look at some of these suspects to camps. They're having problems because the purges are so big that these transit camps are overflowing. First 3 months of 1949 alone, Gray's forces carried out 7 operations with more to come. Deputy Chief Secretary described the waiting deportees as being, quote, in a complete condition of semi-destitution awaiting return to China, where they may be left to starve and not reach their villages at all, he says. He says, much has been written about the inhumanity of mass transfer of population during the war in Europe. And except for the smaller scale on which we are working, it is difficult to distinguish the circumstances which attend to the removal of our Chinese repatriates. There is no question that these operations involve a degree of hardship and inhumanity which is very difficult to defend. And then he goes on to describe what this looks like. If we then fast forward about 6 or 7 years, we're now in Cyprus. And all these are contemporaneous, right? Malaya and Kenya happen at the same time. They're both happening, and Cyprus begins in 1955. And at this point, they have moved in. They've taken people and transferred them from one place to the next. It's then where Colonial Secretary at the time, Alan Lennox Boyd, he's mulling over whether or not he's going to use, as he says, quote-unquote, sickening gas, or as he says, an arsenical material technically classified as a war gas that had been tested on colonial subjects in Hong Kong. And as they're, you know, sort of mulling this over, they start bringing others that describe that they're unanimous, that no written instructions should be given and issued to interrogators. So everything is being done verbally. I go on to say, reports of colonial abuses come flooding into the British government and were notably similar to those from Malaya and Kenya, as well as Palestine. Security forces interrogation teams forced suspects and civilians to take hallucinogenic drugs, strip naked, undergo water torture while handcuffed to bed frames, and suffer through genital mutilation and testicle twisting with torture instruments. They were beaten with various instruments, suffocated with pillows, electrocuted, hung from ceilings and ladders, starved, boxed on the head while wearing metal buckets, tortured with iron head rings affixed with screws that tightened into the temples. Some refused to offer up information, citing the binding nature of their Iyoka, the name of the movement, oath, and their allegiance to Grievous, their leader, and they were murdered. Others gave false as well as usable information and managed to live through their ordeals. They called British interrogators HMTs, or Her Majesty's Torturers, and those who survived their injuries would go on to finger some of them by name and physical description. Colonial authorities, however, took great care to redact their operators' identities. It took a great deal of time to put this book together. There have been many, many who have come before me who have gestured to this kind of systematic violence, including, and I think most importantly, humanists. Here, I say, one just has to glance at the work of Nobel laureates hailing from the empire, Tagore and Yeats among them, to read complex accounts of suffering and resilience that challenge the civilizing ideals of Winston Churchill and Rudyard Kipling, who too had been feted in Stockholm. All these men won Nobel Prizes. Memoirs and local histories from those who lived through colonial rule accompanied other literary contributions, while the field of post-colonial studies, particularly those grounded in works from South Asia, challenged the British imperial narrative that stretched back to the eras of Sealing and Hastings. So did the writings of Stuart Hall, the Jamaican-born scholar activist who co-founded in 1960 the influential New Left Review, as well as the field of British cultural studies, and who, after his death in 1914, was hailed as one of the most influential intellectuals in the last 60 years. In Africa, Josiah Mwangi Kariuki's memoir, Mau Mau Detainee, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o's Weep Not Child, the first novel by an East African to be published in English, offered firsthand accounts of suffering during Kenya's state of emergency. And in North Africa, of course, Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth was a seismic intervention into colonial hagiography when published in 1961. The colonized must be made to see that colonialism never gives away anything for nothing, he wrote. Whatever gains the colonized make through armed or political struggle, they are not the result of the colonizer's goodwill or goodness of heart, but to the fact that he can no longer postpone such concessions. West Africa brought the world Wole Soyinka, who in December 1986 became the first African to receive the Nobel Prize in Literature. Standing before an audience in Stockholm in a stunning beige and white striped dashiki, Soyinka was well aware of the moment's historic meaning. A Yoruba man born at the high noon of Britain's empire, he was free to offer a lecture on any topic. His address was titled, "This Past Must Address Its Present," much like my book, but much better. Signaling he would be dealing with history's injunctions. A shock of gray hair animated his resonant baritone voice as he began with a brief dedication to Nelson Mandela, who, for over 20 years, incarcerated on Robben Island in South Africa, where he remained. Soyinka knew better than anyone the significance not only of his words, but also where he chose to start his story. After framing his thoughts on the world's most famous prisoner, he could have gestured to his Nigeria homeland or to countless other parts of the continent across the 20th century. Instead, he returned to Kenya and to the Hola massacre, where 11 detainees were beaten to death by Waters in 1959, and where the British government initially said they had died from a contaminated water, and in fact it was proven that they had been beaten to death and died from blunt force trauma, which eventually accelerated Britain from leaving the colony. For Soyinka, the story was deeply personal. As a young aspiring writer and actor, he lived in the late 1950s London, where he was part of an improvisation group at the Royal Court Theatre. He recounted to his Stockholm audience that after singing some traditional songs, he had refused to take the stage, in spite of the efforts of black South African actor Boke Modisene to physically pull him into the scene when the thespians were reenacting the beating deaths that had taken place in Kenya's detention camp. The struggle between these men in the late 1950s unfolded in plain view of the audience. And it was something that Africa's first Nobel laureate remembered vividly, as he said, and 30 years later, he felt it necessary to explain himself on that stage in Stockholm. Soyinka said the whole production in front of London's white audience gave off that feeling, "I've been here before. I've been a witness to this. The past enacts its presence. Every death of a freedom fighter was a notch on a gun, not the martyrdom of a patriot," much as Mandela's passage in apartheid's isolated cell continued to feed the sands of white imperialism's hourglass. He then punctuated his memory's muse, inscribed as it was with Enoch Powell's self-serving calls for accountability in Kenya and the empire, and the, quote, "liberals, humanitarians, reformists who had taken up the cause of justice for the victims." And then Soyinka says with a final exhortation, "This profound unease which paralyzed my creative will, I trace its roots to my own feeling of assaulted humanity and its clamor for a difficult form of response. It provoked a feeling of indecency about the presentation, rather like the deformed arm of a leper, which is thrust at the unhealthy to provoke a charitable sentiment. This, I believe, was the cause of that intangible but totally visceral rejection which thwarted the demand of my calling, rendered it inadequate, and mocked the empathy of my colleagues. The inhuman totality of which that scene was a mere fragment was saying to us, kindly keep your comfortable sentiments to yourself." Thank you.
You've been listening to Carolyn Elkins talking about her new book, Legacy of Violence, A History of the British Empire.
For Building Bridges, I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Continue to educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people.